Bible wanted to test the, you know, wanted to prove that Galileo was wrong and show that heavier bodies fell quicker, and they actually did, as he claimed. So this, you know, shows the challenges of experiments. But yeah, so this is, is not the only difference between a computer and a physics experiment. You probably think a computer is a little box that sits on your desk, and a physics experiment is a room full of finicky equipment which always needs adjusting and repairing. But as these pictures show, well, we have here a computer from the time when computers were larger than particle accelerators, and a particle accelerator of around the same size 15 years later. So what's happened is that computers have grown smaller and smaller and smaller, and particle accelerators have grown larger and larger and larger. So you can ask, why do computers get so much smaller and so much better when physics experiments, you know, have improved a lot, but they're nowhere near like, but nowhere near to the degree which computers have improved. Well, there's a second answer, which is you don't need to build a new computer for every new mathematical question you want answered. And this is actually a fairly, the reason for this is really a fairly deep fact about computation. And what has happened is the computers have gotten smaller and much more efficient because of mass production, and physics experiments haven't. So what is this fact? No, why don't you need to build a new computer for each mathematics question you want answered? Well, it's this something called the Church-Turing thesis. And what the Church-Turing thesis says is that a Turing machine can perform any computation that any device can perform. And where this, you know, thesis arose was around 1936. I guess good old theorem, incompleteness theorem, came in 1930, and it was quickly followed by several papers that defined computable and non-computable functions and showed that, characterize them, and there were actually three very different definitions of computable functions. One came from the lambda calculus, one was recursively enumerable functions, and the third was things that can be computed by Turing machines. And after these papers came out, somewhere around 1936, people realized that all these people proved that all these three definitions were the same. And Church and Turing put forth the thesis that the computable function is somehow a natural class of functions, and it doesn't matter which definition you use, any reasonable definition will give you the same class of computable functions. And there were four papers. At least two of them, and possibly three, weren't thinking of computers. They were thinking of this other, inspired by this other definition of a computable as what a mathematician can do scribbling on sheets of paper. Turing actually wrote his, Turing actually had machines in mind when he wrote this paper, and is very, Okay, so back to universality of computers. So, this is the Church-Turing thesis, and, this just says whether a function is computable or not. But when people actually started building computers, they realized that just because a function is theoretically computable doesn't mean you can actually compute it. You need, you need to be able to compute it with a reasonable number of steps so that you don't die of old age before you get the answer. So with the development of practical computers, you really needed a distinction between efficiently computable and not efficiently computable. And somewhere around 1960s, computer scientists came up with the definition that an algorithm is efficient, this is the technical definition of efficient, not the actual definition of efficient, if running time is a polynomial function of its side of its input. And the class of problems which can be solved with efficient algorithms is called P. And this isn't really, you know, not all things that are in P you would actually call efficient. There are algorithms in P which take n to the 8th running time, and you'll never actually be able to compute the answer for even reasonable size input. But this turned out to be a pretty good compromise between theory and practice, because it's very nice for proving theorems with, and most natural problems which are in P are actually moderately efficient. So most of them you can run in N2 running times, say, most natural ones somehow. At least in our, you know, in the experience of theoretical computer scientists. So now we have this definition of P. We need to know that this definition is robust. So we need, computer scientists needed to state that it didn't matter what the model of computer you use, the polynomial time is still polynomial going between these different models. And actually, there are a bunch of models of computers, Turing machines, random access machines, or von Neumann machines, circuits, and you actually lose some small polynomial factors going between these different models, but they're all, polynomial time remains polynomial time. So because computer scientists wanted this definition to be robust, this strengthening of Church's thesis arose, and it's called quantitative Church's thesis. And I've been told that Steve Cook and Dick Karp, someone wanted to call this the Cook-Karp thesis. I was told that Steve Cook and Dick Karp said, no, don't associate our names with them. So I don't know, I don't know whether this is true, but the quantitative Church's thesis says that a Turing machine can perform in polynomial time, any computation, any device can perform in polynomial time. And one of the amazing things about quantum computers is the discovery that if quantum computers can actually be built, this would imply that this Spoke thesis is probably not true. I mean, we can't even prove that P is different from P space, so it's possible that any quantum computers can be simulated in polynomial time, or at least theoretical computer scientists cannot prove that quantum computers cannot be simulated in polynomial time, but I think the bet is that they cannot, and that this Spoke thesis is not true. And of course, what happened was that, because the thesis isn't a theorem, because it says any device. And it actually took a long time for people to realize that Church's thesis, when it says any device, wasn't a statement about mathematics. It was really a statement about physics. And quantum computing has made this quite clear. And the world is not classical, and Church's thesis seems to be about classical stuff. One of the things I find also is that the Church's thesis has really sunk into the consciousness of the public, and probably one of the few mathematical facts it has, because anytime I talk to journalists about quantum computers, they ask, well, how much faster is a quantum computer than a regular computer? And you really can't answer this question, because on factoring, say, 10,000-bit numbers, it's many orders of magnitude faster for balancing your checkbook, or for, say, sorting a long list of names. It's probably much slower, because the clock time of a quantum computer is probably going to be slower than the clock time of a classical computer. So, journalists and the public have really absorbed this quantitative Church's thesis. I mean, if I came, if I talked, you know, if someone said, I have a new design for a rocket ship, the first question anyone is going to, the journalist would ask is, how much faster is it going to be than my car? So, quantum computers really solve different problems than classical computers, and different. So, I now want to talk about a little bit of history. I think this has been gone over earlier this week, but the first person to suggest that quantum computing might be, you know, give a speed up to classical computing, well, was Yuri Manin in the Soviet Union, and Richard Feynman in the U.S. And Richard, in a 1982 paper, Feynman, you know, tried to explain why simulating physics using a digital computer seemed to be inherently exponentially inefficient, and he proposed using a quantum computer to get around this problem. Manin said the same thing in the Soviet Union a couple of years ago, and the reason I don't have his picture up there is that I didn't learn about it until well after I prepared this slide, and I probably should change that. So, a few years later, David Deutsch proposed that quantum computers might speed up computation in non-quantum mechanical problems, and this was a paper he wrote about universal quantum computers, and since then he started looking for problems that quantum computers could speed up, and Deutsch and Joseph found the first such problem. And since then, you know, a number of people have found problems. So, you know, since quantum computers are only going to be good for speeding up certain problems, we know very few problems which quantum computers are actually good for. So, simulating or exploring quantum mechanical systems efficiently is the first one. Second class of problems involves finding periodicity. And this is Dan Simon's problem, which really gave me the insight to find the factoring algorithm, and factoring large integers and finding discrete logarithms efficiently, which, you know, was the discovery that gave a big impetus to the research in quantum computing. And Love Grover, a little while after I found the factoring algorithm, discovered an algorithm that searches large solution spaces more efficiently than classical computers. And so far, this is pretty much it. Okay, so the next thing I want to do is try to explain briefly the model for a quantum computer. And I want to apologize for everyone who's been attending the summer school, because they'll have seen this many times before this week. But before that, I have to say a little bit about quantum mechanics. So, one of the fundamental principles of quantum mechanics is the superposition principle, which says if a quantum system can be in one of two mutually distinguishable states, A and B, it can be in both these states at once. Or more precisely, it can be in a superposition of states alpha A plus beta B, where alpha and beta are complex numbers, and the absolute value of alpha squared plus beta squared equals 1. And now if you look at the system when it's this state, and you try to distinguish between A and B, we assume that A and B are at least theoretically mutually distinguishable, then the chance of seeing it in state A when you carry out this experiment is absolute value of alpha squared, and the chance of seeing it in state B is absolute value of beta squared. So the best example, or the example that's familiar to the most people, is probably the quantum system, probably the polarization of a photon. And we call a two-dimensional quantum system a qubit. And if you have a polarized photon, there are only two distinguishable states. For example, you can distinguish between vertical and horizontal polarizations of the photon by seeing whether it goes through a vertical polarizer. Now, you can also rotate the polarizer 45 degrees and distinguish between right diagonal and left diagonal, but you can't distinguish between right diagonal and vertical. And there are, I said that So if you go back to the superposition principle, what it says in mathematical language is that the state of a quantum system is a vector space, and orthogonal vectors are distinguishable. So we can see that these can be expressed as linear combinations of these two basis vectors, and these, you know, right diagonal and left diagonal are orthogonal, and also vertical, you know, right circular polarization and left circular polarization are orthogonal. And here you get imaginary numbers. Okay, so that's a one qubit. Suppose you have two qubits. Well, by the superposition principle, two qubits can be in any superposition of these four states. And here is where quantum mechanics starts becoming really non-classical. For example, this includes states such as this, you know, vertical, horizontal, minus horizontal, vertical, which is called an EPR pair of photons. And these, you can't say that either qubit alone has a definite state. They're only a definite state when you consider both qubits together, and things like this are called entangled states. And where quantum computing lives is in the joint state space of n qubits, which is described by a 2 to the n dimensional vector. And now we're going to become super computer scientists rather than physicists and start labeling basis vectors 0 and 1 rather than vertical and horizontal. So the basis states of the vectors are all binary strings of length n. So this is a 2 to the n dimensional vector space. And the high dimensionality of this space is one of the places where quantum computing obtains its power. So, how do you compute? Well, I think these are at least minimum needs for computing. I don't know any computer where you can't do one of these, or any usable computer where you cannot do one of these three operations. So to compute, you need to put the input into the computer, you need to change the state of the computer, and you need to get the output out of the computer. And remarkably, each of these three operations is a bottleneck for some of the architectures for quantum computing. So what I'm going to describe is the circuit model for quantum computers. And I want to say this isn't the only model. For classical computers, you had Turing machines and random access memory machines and circuits and all sorts of other things. And they're all, in some sense, equivalent. And the same is true for quantum computing. And I think the circuit model is probably the most natural one to think about, especially when you're thinking about the physics of it. But it's, you know, if you actually build a quantum computer, it's going to differ in some ways from this model. But there seems to be a universality theorem for quantum computing, in that any of these various models for quantum computers are all equivalent up to polynomial factors. So for the circuit model, we have these n qubits, and we need to start put the input into the computer, and the easiest way to do this is start the computer in the state corresponding to the input in binary. And in order to do real computation, you're going to have to have some extra workspace, which starts with which starts in the state of all zeros, say, or in some other fixed initial state. Output. Well, when you're done with the computation, your computer is going to be in some state, which is a superposition of basis vectors with various amplitudes on the vectors. So alpha I, probability amplitude for being in state I. And what we're going to assume you do to get the output is measure this state in the canonical basis. So you get the output, which is a binary string of length n, output I with probability absolute value of alpha sub I squared. Now, you certainly cannot measure the state completely. And in fact, this measurement seems to be as, up to small efficiency factors as good as any way of getting the output out of the computer. And again, it's much easier to think about than a general measurement. Okay, and because of quantum mechanics, this is a probabilistic process, so we're going to ask for a probabilistic model of computation. So we want to get the output that gives them, we want to say our computer computes the answer to the problem if it gives us output that gives the right answer with high probability. We're not asking for 100%. So the next thing is I want to say how to compute with the computer, or how to change the state of the computer. And for that, we need a little bit more quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics says that the evolution of an isolated quantum system is linear. So, well, we're talking about a linear operation on a vector space. That's just a matrix. And to preserve probability, it's easy to check that the matrices in quantum mechanics have to be unitary. So what we're going to allow our computer to do is apply transformations to qubits, two at a time. And one way of, you know, one way of justifying this is the classical circuit model applies, you know, gates to wires two at a time. And a quantum gate, we're going to take some, you know, two inputs, apply some matrix, and get an output. And the output now is, in general, going to be an entangled state of these two wires, even if the states on the two qubits weren't entangled at the beginning. And one thing to note is that because of unitarity of the matrices, you need to have as many wires coming out of a quantum gate as going in. And a computation in the circuit model is going to be a sequence of quantum gates applied to either one or two qubits at a time. And again, like the classical model, from the classical computation circuit model, the AND, the OR, and the NOT gate are all the gates you need to compute with. And in fact, you only need two. I mean, you can do away with either the AND or the OR. For quantum gates, you know, you can choose a small set of gates and show that they efficiently simulate any one or two bit gates. And in fact, most small sets of gates are universal. And here's one such set. So what's a quantum computation? Well, here is a schematic diagram of quantum computation. You're going to start with the input. You're going to perform gates on each of the qubits, which and get it, you know, end up in some very complicated state of the computer. You measure it. And that's your output. So each line represents one qubit, and time is going from left to right. And here are some, some of the gates you might use. Okay. So where do quantum computers obtain all the power? Well, I can tell you how not to do computations with quantum computers. I mean, if you can, you know, there's this idea that, you know, quantum computers are parallel, but if you start in a superposition of inputs and then apply deterministic computation, you end up with a superposition of outputs, and then when you observe the output, you get a random one of these outputs, and, you know, you trace this back through your path, you end up, it's the same as taking a random input and doing a classical computation, which means, and the reason I'm, you know, reason I'm saying this is this, you know, little thought experiment shows that you really need to use interference in a quantum computer to get the right answer, or to get, not the right answer, to get a speed up from classical computation. So the idea behind fast quantum computer algorithms is you somehow want to arrange the algorithm to make all the computational paths that produce the wrong answer destructively interfere, so you never actually observe them, and all the computational paths that produce the right answer constructively interfere, and this greatly increases the probability of obtaining the right answer. Actually, if you make all the computational paths that produce the wrong answer destructively interfere to zero, you automatically get the fact that the ones which produce the right answer get amplified. But, you know, this is something that's fairly difficult to think about how to do. And I think that's one of the reasons we haven't seen more, you know, problems solved with quantum algorithms, is that this is, you know, something that, well, this is something that we never think about doing in classical computers, so we haven't really got a good handle on how to do it right yet. I mean, there's another possibility, which is there just aren't very many more quantum computer algorithms for interesting problems. And that's why we haven't seen them. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to do is, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about doctoring. So quantum computers give an exponential speedup for factoring large integers. The factoring problem is given a number n, find two numbers smaller than it that multiply to n. And once you do that, you can recursively factor a and b and get down to prime factors. So to do prime factorization, all you need to do is to be able to factor a number into two pieces. So how fast do quantum computers factor? Well, I mean, you can't actually give times because we don't know. I mean, we can compare quantum computers to classical computers by counting the number of steps. But a single step on a quantum computer is almost certain to take longer than a single step on a classical computer. And I think the best example of this is NMR computers, where a single step takes 1/100th of a second, which is 6 or 7 orders of magnitude slower than classical computers. So to get quantum computers to speed up with NMR machines, you really need to drastically reduce the number of steps. Of course, if you look at the estimates on quantum factors, plus the factors, using known algorithms, say factoring a 600-digit number using the number field sieve would take somewhere on the order of 10 to the 33rd steps. And on a quantum computer, it would take less than 10 to the 12th steps. So there's 21 orders of magnitude right there. Of course, if you want to do this reasonably quickly, you need to do at least 10 to the 7th or 10 to the 8th steps a second. Okay, and here is the running time. So the best classical method is a number field sieve, which heuristically is believed to run in the time exponential in the cube root of the number of digits. And quantum computer can factor an L-bit number in the time little more than L squared, and for small L it runs in L cubed. You get the improvement from L cubed to L squared by using fast integer multiplication, which doesn't start to actually be faster until L is quite long. So you're, you know, by the time you're factoring 200-digit numbers, you're probably getting in this range. But factoring, say, 10-digit numbers, which is, you know, the first prototype quantum computers might do, if we're lucky, is L cubed. Okay, so before I actually give you the factoring algorithm, I'm going to explain the algorithm for solving Dan Simon's problem, which was, you know, my one of my inspirations for finding the factoring algorithm. And you'll see that the algorithms are really very similar in outline. So Dan Simon's problem, which he discovered how to do in around 1993, says, given a function f that maps, you know, vectors in the binary field on the n-bit binary field into the n-bit binary field, such that there's a C such that f of x equals f of y, if and only if x equals c plus y mod, you're adding in binary without carrying, so mod v2 to the n, you want to find c. So one thing to notice is this is an oracle problem, so you're just given this function f as a black box and you're not allowed to look in it. And so classically, you can show that it takes order of 2 to the n over 2 times. And this, I am lying a little bit here, but essentially the only thing you can do is try random x's until you find 2 where f of xi equals f of xj, and then c is equal to xi minus xj, which, since we're dealing with a binary field, equals xi plus xj. And by the birthday paradox, well, you have 2 to the n minus 1 different possible values of f, and you need to try around 2, the square root of that, to get 2 which are equal, so that's around 2 to the n over 2 different tries of the function, and so that's 2 to the n over 2 times. So on a quantum computer, you can do it in time n rather than 2 to the n, or actually, I guess, n squared rather than 2 to the n. So you start by, you're going to have two registers here. Each of them is going to contain an n-bit binary number over the field, f2 to the n. And over the vector space f2 to the n. And you start with the first register in equal superposition of all binary numbers, and the second register equal to 0. The first step is you take the number in your first register, and you compute f of x in the second register. And you're allowed to do this because f of x is given to you as a black box, so you assume you can do that. The second step, you take, I guess I was missing a slide, but the second step, what you do is for each number, each bit in this register, you apply a Hadamard transform, which takes a 0 to a 0 plus 1, and a 1 to a 0 minus 1. And what that does is it takes vector x to an equal superposition of all vectors y with the amplitude minus 1 to the x dot y, where x dot y means you multiply in binary, with the dot product in binary, so when you add them up, you either get minus 1 to the 1 or minus 1 to the 0. And next, you observe the state. So to find the probability that you see y in f of x, you need to add up all the ways you could have gotten to y f of x in this algorithm. And there's two ways, because there's exactly two y's that will produce the same f of x. And those y's are, again, those y's are either, or there's two x's that would have produced the same f of x. So these x's are x and x plus c. So you get there by minus 1 to the x dot y and minus 1 to the c plus x dot y. So these are two amplitudes. And when you add them up, you can notice that if c dot y is even, this, you get 2 here, and if c dot y is odd, you get 0. Yeah, so you see y f of x with probability 1 over 2 to the n minus 2 if y dot c equals 0, and 0 if y dot c equals 1. And this means you observe a random y with c dot y equals 0. And that means you observe a random vector in the vector, the subspace that is perpendicular to c. And if you get enough vectors to get a basis for that state, that vector space, you can figure out c from that. And you can show that, you know, you just need around n vectors to determine C uniquely. So you get order of n trials, and each trial takes n steps, so that's order of n squared steps, and that's, you know, exponential speed up over the classical algorithm. So now for factoring. The idea behind all factoring algorithms, which includes the number field sieve and, you know, all the classical factoring algorithms of the last 40 years, I think, and including the quantum algorithms, in the very broad outline, you factor a large number n, you find numbers a and b, such as a squared equals b squared mod n, but a is not equal to plus or minus b mod n. And now you can take this equation, subtract it, and factor, and you get a plus b times a minus b is a multiple of n. So, well, if a is not equal to plus or minus b mod n, that means a plus b contains one factor, and a minus b contains another factor. And it turns out you can extract these factors using the Euclidean algorithm for finding the greatest common divisor, and that's polynomial time. So that means if you can find these a's and b's, you're done. So how are we going to factor a large number n? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to look at a sequence x to the a mod n. That should really be on the next line. And, you know, eventually the sequence is going to start repeating because it's, you know, this can only have n possibilities. And it starts repeating after period r, because if you get x to the r congruent to 1, then x to the r plus 1 is congruent to x to the 1, x to the r plus 2 is congruent to x squared, etc. So it starts repeating after r steps. And now suppose r just happens to be even. Well, x to the r is a square, and 1 is a square, and if we're a little bit more lucky, x to the r plus 1 over 2 plus 1 will contain one factor of n, and x to the r over 2 minus 1 will contain another factor of n. And it turns out that if you use, it's an exercise in number theory to show that if you choose an x at random, this will let you factor at least half the time, and usually much more often. So now all we have to do is find the period of x to the a mod n. So how do you find the period? There's an example. If you have x equals 5, then the period is 10. X to the 10 over 2 is 5 to the 5th, which is equal to 23 mod 33. And now 23 plus 1 contains one factor of 33, the factor 3, and 23 minus 1 contains a factor 11. So we factor 33. So how do we find the period of x to the a mod n? Well, intuitively, Fourier transforms are very good at finding periods. The problem is that the sequence has an exponentially long period, but it turns out that we can use the exponentially large state space in the quantum computer to take an exponentially large Fourier transform efficiently. Okay, we're nearly done now. Okay, I can give you after this slide, I can give you the algorithm. So, what is this slide? What is a quantum Fourier transform? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to have k qubits, and these numbers x and y are now going to be integers, and between 0 and 2 to the k minus 1 expressed in binary notation, and the quantum Fourier transform maps x to the sum over all possible y's, e to the 2 pi I xy over 2 to the k, with a square root of 2 to the k normalization factor. So this is a unitary transformation. That's fairly easy to check. It's not expressed as a sequence of qubit gates, so what we can, I mean, this, is just a 2 to the k by 2 to the k matrix, the way I've expressed it here. So you need to break it into a series of 2-bit gates. So how do you do that? Well, it turns out if you know how the Cooley-Tookie fast Fourier transform works, you can easily take that and adopt it to order k squared sets. And actually, we're not going to have time to show how this works in this talk. But so this is the quantum Fourier transform. So what's the factoring algorithm? Well, it looks a lot like Dan Simon's algorithm. Again, we're going to need two registers. The first is going to have two L qubits, and the second is going to have L qubits. And we're also going to use some extra workspace. And it's easy to keep the workspace under 3L qubits. And if you work substantially harder, you can get it down to a little low of L qubits. So asymptotically, you only need 3L qubits to factor an L bit number. And in fact, you can get, you can do better than that too by reducing this first register. But I'm not going to get into that. So here's the algorithm. We're going to start, again, as in Dan Simon's algorithm, by putting the first register in the superposition of all integers between 0 and 2 to the 2L. Now, first register had 2L qubits. So that's roughly numbers between 0 and a little more than n squared. Now, the next thing, we need to take the integer a in the first register and compute x to the a mod n in the second register. So how do we do that? Well, what we have to do is we have to find a reversible algorithm for exponentiation. And then if you can find a reversible algorithm for exponentiation, you can turn it into a classical circuit. And a classical circuit is a classical reversible circuit. And a classical reversible circuit is a special case of a quantum circuit. And luckily, Charlie Bennett in the 1970s showed that any computation can be made reversible as long as you keep the input around. So here, we kept A around. So that means we can take this, turn this 0 into x to the a mod n. Okay, the next step is a Fourier transform, and that takes a into the sum over all c e to the 2 pi I ac over 2 to the 2l. So now, and I should have said that it's for this step that you need the extra workspace. So, and now we observe the computer. Well, what do we have? Well, we're going to, we need to figure out how many ways we can observe this number c x to the, or how many ways we can produce this number c x to the a mod n, and then add up all these e to the 2 pi I ac over 2 to the 2l factors and square it to figure out the probability. So how can you produce this state? Okay, that's the state here, c x to the a mod n. Well, let's let a naught be the smallest non-negative integer such that x to the a is congruent to x to the a naught mod n. Well, remember x to the a was periodic with period r, so that means that x to the a naught and x to the a naught plus r and x to the a naught plus 2r are all going to contribute to this amplitude. And in fact, each of them is going to give an additive term e to the 2 pi I a naught plus vr times c over 2 to the 2l, where v runs between 0 and 2 to the 2l over r plus or minus 1. So we will observe state c with probability e to the 2 pi I vrc over 2 to the 2l. Well, this is a geometric series. And in fact, it's a geometric series of vectors which are all in the unit circle. And it's very easy to show that No, since they're all equally spaced around the unit circle, this is going to sum up to something very close to zero, unless the difference between, you know, two adjacent ones is, you know, unless when you start, you know, looking at these vectors, you only go partway around the unit circle. If you go around the unit circle more than a few times, you know, this adds up to something close enough to zero to it be ignored. So, well, we want it to, well, there are 2 to the 2L over R of these vectors, and the difference between, and so we want each of them to be, the difference between these, RC over 2 to the 2L, to be close to an integer D. So, we know that any C we observe will have the property that RC over 2 to the 2L is very close to an integer D. And that's equivalent to DR is approximately C over 2 to the 2L. Okay. We also know that R is less than N because, you know, R is the period of the sequence, and there are only n possible numbers to be in the sequence, and they don't repeat. So R is less than n. And we also know that 2 to the 2L is around n squared. So that what this means is that D over R is going to be the closest fraction to C over 2 to the 2L with numerator and denominator less than n, or if not the closest, one of the closest. And it turns out we can use continued fractions to find D over R from C over 2 to the 2L. Continued fractions are, you know, a number theoretic way of approximating a fraction given some number, which is, you know, approximating a real number using fractions. And then we can use R to factor n, and we're done. So, for example, factoring 33. And 33 is small enough that you can actually compute the exact probabilities of finding the various C's given that you're using the algorithm.